Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Welcome to Still Watching Falcon and the Winter Soldier. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
This is, I was going to say, our last episode on this, but I think we're going to have one more wrap up because I've just got one more interview that I am dying to do. So there will be one more bonus episode. Richard may not be, may or may not be roped into doing that. But this is our finale discussion of Falcon the Winter Soldier on Still Watching. And what Still Watching is, if you are joining us for the first time, this is a podcast where Richard and I pick a show that we're watching kind of closely and we break it down week by week. So sometimes we have conversations with people who work on the show. And for our Marvel content, we've been inviting our pal Anthony Bresnikan on for the sort of end segment to get a little geeky and comic booky about everything. This is it for us for Marvel for a little bit, because I don't know whether or not we're going to do the Loki show, but it's not back till June anyway. So we have – Richard, what have we – been doing? What have we already started doing?
We've been heading to Easttown, to Pennsylvania, to look at Mayor of Easttown and her exploits on that HBO show with Kate Winslet. So we already have one of those episodes in the feed, and we'll keep doing that for the rest of its season, which is, it's whodunit. So, you know, it's fun at least to talk about, you know, theories and all that, if it's, you know, even though the subject matter is pretty grim.
All the feedback that I've gotten from our listeners so far is that they really love the first episode. So it looks like we're going to have a really fun, if occasionally grim, time talking about that series. We got a lot of emails about our accent discussion. So we will talk about those on Sunday nights. On Sunday. So you can get Mayor of Easttown episode 1 already in our feed, and Mayor of Easttown episode 2 will be up on Sunday, Oscar Sunday. What a night. All right. So we're going to get into the episode itself. We've got two great interviews actually this week on this episode. We've got two Captains America, if you will. We've got the great Carl Lumley, who, spoiler alert, was my favorite part of this finale. And we've got Wyatt Russell, the other would-be captain. So we will hear from both Carl and Wyatt on this episode. Before we get into any of that, though, Richard, I'm curious if anyone emailed us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com to give us their Falcon and Winter Soldier ideas, thoughts, questions.
Yeah, there was one email that jumped out at me. It doesn't have really much to do with like what happens in this finale, but it's kind of useful to think about when like assessing the show as a whole and maybe Marvel as a whole. So Zachary wrote to us, I was wondering what your take is on Marvel queer baiting its audience these last few MCU projects, telling us Valkyrie is bisexual, but only showing her flirt with Thor and Hulk/Bruce Banner. Promising a gay character in Endgame, only for it to be an unnamed character cameoed by one of the directors. Bringing Billy and Tommy into WandaVision, but killing them off before they hit puberty so Marvel doesn't have to deal with their sexual orientation. And now the Falcon and the Winter Soldier. After the first episode, Malcolm Spellman was asked about Bucky being bisexual, and he told the fans to, quote, keep watching. Obviously, nothing came of this, and he could have just shot that question down, but he queerbaited the audience to keep viewers engaged. It's especially sad in this series when the show is about how everyone deserves to be seen and represented. Loki's series comes next, and he's usually portrayed as bi or and gender fluid in the comics, but the movies have mostly made him asexual, though I'm in no way diminishing asexuality. So I'm not holding my breath for anything on that front. Obviously, I know Marvel has to think about ticket sales, especially China, but I was hoping these Disney Plus series would give us some queer representation. Though maybe I shouldn't be too surprised since they also moved Love, Victor from Disney Plus to Hulu because of adult content, even as Falcon and the Winter Soldier can show some pretty gratuitous violence in almost every episode.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what do you think? points were made, it feels like.
It's interesting. I was looking up, I was trying to see what exactly Malcolm Spellman said. And it looks like he said, I'm not diving down rabbit holes, but just keep watching. Which is, it is a really odd response to that question. You know, especially when this series does a lot to give Bucky like a female, not a lot, a bare minimum to give Bucky a female love interest when he has never had one so far in the films.
It's possible. I want to give him the benefit of the doubt, Spellman, the benefit of the doubt, that like, I think when you work on those shows or those movies, like, you really, really don't. You were sworn to so much secrecy.
Totally, totally.
That you probably have to be cryptic about everything, even if it does, in hindsight, feel like a misdirect.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there are so many things that they're told not to comment on. I do think keep watching is not the language that I would use if I was trying to like throw cold water on something or be evasive, right. Because that sounds like a promise of something. But the Bucky thing has been so interesting at Marvel for so long, because the reason that The Winter Soldier is my favorite of the Marvel movies is because there is, like, I think my favorite Marvel love story at the center of it. And I'm not even necessarily talking about, like, you know, an explicitly queer or sexual. It's just, like, Steve loves Bucky. And it's all about trying to, like, reach and connect and hold on to Bucky. And whether that's, like, platonic love or however you describe it, that's what drives the Winter Soldier, that film. And that's why I love it so much, because there's like an emotional core at the center of it. And then, you know, the fans sort of got really excited about that connection. And then there became, like, you know, in the era of Tumblr, especially, et cetera, and in the era of scarce representation, fandoms will create these slash ships, I think, as they're called. And I'm all for them, and I'm in support of them. But I do think that, like, Marvel, I don't know if it's fair to presume, but it feels to me like Marvel got a little uncomfortable with how much people were into, like, the Steve and Bucky of it all. And that's how I interpret this, like, aggressive heteroing of Steve in Endgame, when they don't even give, like, Bucky and Steve an emotional farewell, and instead, like, it's all focused on Peggy and Steve, which I'm down with Peggy and Steve, but I just, like, that Bucky Steve connection really gets just sort of the short shrift at the end of Chris Evans' time on there. So that was probably a longer, more rambling answer than you wanted, but what do you think, Richard?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, I feel Zachary's frustration. I mean, I'm not, to be honest, I'm not that deeply invested in, like, whether or not there's a queer character in Marvel.
Sure.
But I think the general sense of, like, you know, mainstream studio network media kind of pulling those little baity kind of moves, that is frustrating in a more macro sense. Absolutely. I think more granularly, let's not, you know, discount the fact that at the end of WandaVision, she hears her kids' voices crying out for help. So, like, I don't think those characters are gone.
Yeah.
I know that's, like, maybe cold comfort for those of us, myself included, who were sort of wondering if they might just kind of age them up within the run of WandaVision episodes and have something happen there. But that, you know, didn't. And, you know, I think in the case, I wasn't aware that there had been this interview with Spellman where he said, just keep watching. I wasn't really even... I know that there is, like, the ship between Steve and Bucky and all that, but I guess I sometimes don't know how seriously the people intend those kind of fandom things, you know. I've actually run afoul of other fandoms by treating a slash ship more frivolously than they did. I won't name names, but so yeah, it's a complicated thing. Yes, there is an underlying business thing. There is an underlying prejudice thing happening. But I think in the course of these shows, these particular shows that we've covered, WandaVision and now Falcon and the Winter Soldier, I don't feel a lack yet. You know, I'm just sort of like, well, these are short runs. They had this story to tell and then they're done. And I will welcome, I'd rather get a queer character who isn't just sort of like mentioned, or there's a queerness grafted onto an extant character. I'd rather get someone who has like actual like texture and developed, you know, personality, which like maybe will come in the future when that's what the story of the show or whatever it is.
Well, yeah, and here's I don't mean to pull a keep watching on anyone listening, but I will say that like it's my understanding that Tessa Thompson's Valkyrie character, which yes, Tessa Thompson, the actress who plays Valkyrie, said in interviews she's bisexual. I believe that that both she and director Taika Waititi have indicated that you know that implicit backstory or whatever will be explicit in Thor Love and Thunder that's coming up. I think Tessa Thompson said on the stage of Hall H at Comic-Con, like, now that she is the king, she'll be looking for her queen. So, like, I think that is coming in Thor Love and Thunder, which will be out in the near future. And also, I believe there is a gay character in Eternals, and not just, like, a cameo gay character, but a significant gay character in Eternals. So, keep watching, in the words of Malcolm Spellman, but I suppose not for Bucky, because that's not the road they've decided to go down for Bucky, which is too bad, because Sebastian Stan has had a good history in queer roles, but that's okay. Does that answer the question? I think.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, again, just to reiterate, I feel the frustration. I understand it. I'm not trying to minimize it.
No.
But I think my personal view on it is like, I would rather it be done well than done perfunctorily, you know? Mm-hmm. And I know that Zachary was kind of cognizant of like how silly the sort of big touting of the gay character in Endgame was. And it was literally like one scene, random, unnamed character kind of thing.
Yeah.
So yes, it is time. We want more of it. It's coming in Eternals, and it's coming in the Thor movie, so you know it'll be there.
So that is it for emails for this episode. We, like I said, we're going to be doing a wrap-up episode next week of some kind. So if you have finale thoughts, especially after you hear what we have to say about the finale, please do email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Let us dive really quickly into this finale episode. I'm not super up on it. Richard, how are you feeling about this finale?
Not up at all.
Yeah.
I think there are admirable moments contained within, but once we got to Sam's big speech in front of a senator and lots of people watching on the street, I was like, this tonally feels very forced, I guess you could call it.
Like, maybe if they had 8 episodes, this all wouldn't have felt so truncated. But I just feel like one of my bigger problems rests with John Walker. And Wyatt Russell gave us a lovely interview. So this really has nothing to do with Wyatt Russell or his performance, because I think he's quite good in the role. I just think it's really tough to go from such a dark place in episode 4, where there's, like, blood dripping off the Captain America shield, to, like, you know, a minimal appearance in episode 5, but nothing that, like, felt transformative for that character. He still felt very stuck in the I was right sort of place in episode 5. And then in episode 6, he shows up. He does have a moment in the heat of battle where he's like, this is not who I want to be. I want to be the hero. Like, that's who I really am. I am a hero. Even if I'm not Captain America, I'm a hero. So he has that moment. But it just feels so fast and without much processing. And then all of a sudden, like, Bucky's sort of quipping with him, and Sam's giving him, like, nods of approval. And he's just like, I'm back. Like, there just wasn't time for that character to complete the arc in a way that didn't feel like Whiplash. What do you think?
Yeah, totally. And they tried to establish a crucial, you know, choice moment for him when he could pursue the people he wants to get revenge on for killing right. his friend and partner, or he could save the people. And he's like, I got to save the people. And then he drops the makeshift shield as if to say, like, I give, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, but that moment did not feel arrived at with any real, like, accumulation of story. You know, it just kind of was like, oh, right, we got to kind of tend to him and make sure that he can, you know, be at least somewhat reconciled with the good people by the end of this episode, to sort of set up, I guess, season two. Yeah, it felt frustrating, you know, like, and especially after Zemo kind of getting, like, just sort of dealt with and then tossed aside, it felt like that again. And then, you know, not that something always needs a distinct villain, because Carly and the Flag Smashers weren't really that either. But it just kind of felt a bit scattered and unfocused, and I'm not sure why they went the direction of having this kind of bifurcated conflict at root in the season.
Well, I think they were... So what they wanted to give us was all these villains with a point, right? Everyone's a Killmonger. Everyone's Michael B. Jordan from Black Panther, where you sort of agree with their perspective, but not with their methods. And again, I just don't know that, you know, and so they're trying to give us that in Zemo, in Carly, in Sharon, in John. So you've got, like, sort of four antagonistic sources at least that are supposed to be also sympathetic in some way. And it's a big lift to spread your focus like that. I think if they had given us, like, I think there was an opportunity to give us, like, just the character of Carly and develop her as an antagonist who has like human motivations and human goals. And, you know, she wants to protect her people, these refugees that, you know, are in danger of being displaced because of, you know, various governments. And once again, and it's also shady and nebulous too. Like, what do the Flag Smashers want? What do the government want? What are they stopping? What are they doing? Like, it all just felt very, like, soft and loose and vague in a way that, like, doesn't, I think, in the end serve their goal, you know? To make us feel, I felt for Carly in various moments, but, like, she doesn't stand out to me as this, like, great, great character who is doing something that I'm uncomfortable with, but I see so clearly where she's coming from. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. We need more of her, you know, more like, you know, backstory, just like moments where she was a real character, not right. just kind of this stand in for an idea.
Yeah.
And I think in a bigger sense with the end, with the Isaiah character getting his due at this museum, you know, very A League of Their Own finale. And Sam becoming Captain America, despite what he knows about what the government has done to Isaiah and what it's done just in general, there's this real boosterism in this episode for, like, opting into a system. And I understand the idea behind that in terms of, well, it's pragmatic, you can't, you know, we're not going to blow this whole thing up, we have to work within it to, like, fix it. And I get that, I do, but it, you know, coming just in the week of the verdict in Minnesota and everything, it just feels very creaky and kind of like very post 9/11, like immediately post 9/11, just like support the troops, don't question the mission, kind of, you know, even though they did question some of the mission. I just, the politics of this finale really clanked for me. Mm-hmm. And I think that was made all the starker by this really corny, zoomed out of the 1980s or 90s speech where everyone's just listening and standing there for some, you know, it's like, I thought that moment was so unearned, especially because a lot of the other stuff that they've done with Sam's character and exploring, like, how race has been a function in the Avengers narrative and in the U.S. foreign policy narrative and military narrative was a lot more subtle. And I just felt that the speech kind of made everything in hindsight seems kind of corny.
Yeah. And you mentioned Carl Lumley, Isaiah. This is the only emotional journey that really worked for me in the finale. Truly. And I really think it comes down to his performance being so good.
Sure.
That his emotions being so accessible rather than the writing feeling like a natural flow of a character. Because he was so defiant last week. And then he just like sees Sam do one thing on the TV and he sort of like changed his mind. And again, I really think Carl Lumley sold that to us. In a way that did work for me, and I clung to it as an emotional beat that really, really did work for me. But the Sam of it all, like I want to be so excited to see Sam step fully into his power. Like that's what I want. I want Sam to have whatever, you know, role he wants. I want him to be the hero that he wants to be. I'm just not sure I fully understand why he went from that conversation with Isaiah to putting on this costume. And then also on a really superficial level, I don't think the costume works very well.
It looks silly.
It looks silly. I'm sorry.
It looks with the kind of wraparound Oakley's red tinted. I know that those kind of lenses have functioned in like the Falcon costume and other things, but like with the brighter white and blue, it looks like an action figure, but like an older action figure. It just, there's something about it that I kind of guffawed when he first showed up in it.
I mean, I didn't guffaw, but like, you know, there was so much said about John Walker's costume and how it looked wrong on him. Like the Captain America costume looked wrong on him. And I think this costume looks wrong on Sam, not for character reasons, but just design wise. I think it's not, I would call Wakanda and be like, appreciate it. Really appreciate the effort. Thank you for these amazing wings. They're incredible. They appear to be a vibranium. Amazing. Can we rethink the costume design? I think we should.
Well, especially because he's presumably not just fighting crime between Memorial Day and Labor Day. And that's the only time anyone can wear white. So, I mean, and you know, so I just feel like that's another thing that this episode didn't think about.
It's also not fair because Bucky gets to look so cool. Bucky in his like one arm leather jacket and Bucky looks amazing and Sam looks so dorky. And I'm like, no, Sam should look so cool. Yeah. I did like the moment of the action that I liked is sort of that whole like communication with the pilot who was inside the helicopter and the coordinated save and stuff like that. Like that was a moment that felt very Captain America to me, where like, you know, a Steve would sort of connect with a civilian, or not a civilian in this case, and like be like, okay, we're going to do this together. Are you ready? Like, let's do this. That felt like a very Captain America moment to me that I really liked. But yeah, the speechifying it didn't land for me. And again, this is not that like I don't think Sam should be Captain America. I just like want Sam being Captain America to be better, if that makes sense. And then let's talk about the Sharon of it all. I'm assuming you watched the mid-credits sequence?
I did, for once. Okay. I remembered. Yeah.
Okay.
You know what I love to do when I have like really nefarious plans?
Yeah.
So I've just been exonerated in the U.S. Capitol.
Of course.
I love to walk halfway down the stairs and
only
then
halfway.
Full volume talk on my phone about my evil plan.
Me too. If I have a mustache, I'll twirl it. But if not, I'll just let my like frosted blonde hair blow in the breeze. This is just not fair for Emily Van Camp to have to play this. Okay, so we guessed early on that Sharon Carter might be the power broker, right? They led some breadcrumbs, so this wasn't like a shocking surprise. And talking to Emily Van Camp about it, like, she seemed really into this idea of like a Sharon Carter who had been left out to twist in the wind and felt betrayed by her country. This idea of Captain America's most eager foot soldier has been sort of twisted because the whole idea of Captain America isn't what we all want it to be. I still, at the end of the day, have a really hard time believing that Steve Rogers would have... This is why I was like trying to complicate it by being like, maybe she's a double-double agent or something like that. But like, I just have a hard time believing that Steve Rogers would have left Sharon out in the cold like that. He kissed her. That's his version of going steady. And also, complicatedly, she is kind of his niece. So I just don't, you know, Steve is gone. Like, what's frustrating, right, is that they never tell us what's going on with Steve. Is he back in another timeline? Has he actually died? Like, they just say he's gone. They won't commit to where he's gone. But like, Steve has time, if he has time to bring Sam the shield, if he has time to do various things even before he goes back in time, he has time to check in on Sharon Carter. And so what they're asking me to believe is that Steve would have just kind of forgotten about Sharon Carter. And I don't think he would have. Maybe this, what are you feeling about the power broker of it all?
Yeah, well, we got an email from a listener named Jeff who kind of basically was like, I don't buy that Steve would treat her like that. He did have time. There were 5 years during the blip. I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, I guess, because I kind of didn't quite remember where her character had ended up in when we last saw her.
Well, even if she was listed as missing because she had gone underground. And so even if Steve thought she had been snapped, so didn't look for her for those 5 years because he thought she was just dust, there were still other pockets of time for him to go looking for her. Anyway, go ahead.
I guess even heroes can be like ghosters, you know? It's kind of shitty men just don't get in touch with people. I think it's fun that Emily Van Camp, who's a good actor, and I've watched her in many things, and I think this is kind of hearkening back to her in Revenge. It's fun to watch her kind of be wicked and have that little surprise and everything. Yeah. But I think it also just felt like they literally had a character walk out 2 seconds after it was semi-revealed that she was in cahoots with Carly. Another character walked out and said, oh, so you're the power broker. And it was like, oh, okay. It felt like they were really rushing that reveal to the extent that they just had to literally say it out loud. And then to follow that up with, this kind of, let's talk about my evil plan, mere steps away from the people I'm trying to be spying on. That felt silly. I think in a bigger sense, though, Sharon being welcomed back into the fold and sort of still working against it for who we don't really know, I guess. That weirdly feels like kind of where Sam's arc should have gone instead, because he has this realization about how rotten at the core because of racism and discrimination this whole enterprise has been for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And then the episode ends, and then the new episode, he's completely opted back in. And the series, you know, placates you by thinking, if you make one impassioned speech to a stubborn senator, they'll change their mind and everything will be fine. So don't try to fight it any harder than that. You know, appeal to emotion and then just trust in the system. And that clearly, given current reality in the real world, like, that's not how things work. And I feel like, even though she's going off to do nefarious things, Sharon is keener to that reality than Sam is. And I think that sort of weirdly gives her the closure or the catharsis or something that he kind of should have gotten over the course of this season.
One thing I wonder, this is something Emily Van Camp said to me in our interview last week, is that she was shooting this and her other show, The Resident, at the same time. And there was a lot of scheduling, careful scheduling they had to do. And I just almost wonder if, you know, they really wanted Sharon Carter. She really wants to do it. She's on this other show. They make it work. But by make it work, that means she's like on the other side of a phone call in 2 episodes. Do you know what I mean? And so it's like, if I don't know if they had full access to her, if there was something more developed they could have done for her character that could have made me feel like we got to where we need to go. But like, okay, so if you're listening to this, maybe you've already shut this off, but you're listening to this and you're like, oh, they're so negative, I really love the episode, I bet you so much that Anthony Brezikin liked this better than both of us, because that, you know, Anthony generally has like a rosier outlook on life, I think, than both of us. So stay tuned for later. You might hear Anthony, you know, make the case for why this worked for him. And we also have 2 great interviews. So I just want to say that, like, it's okay if you disagree with us. That's fine if you loved it.
We're not trying to rain on parades.
I just wanted it to be great. And I just didn't feel like it was great. And it actually feels like, to me, the shakiest installment that we've seen from Marvel for a good long time. That's how I feel about this show. Yeah. They said they might do a second season, and I'm at the point right now where I don't really want that. It's not that I don't want to see these characters again. I just don't know that I want, the closing title card was Captain America and the Winter Soldier. Like, I don't know that I even want like a Captain America and the Winter Soldier show, unless they, you know, have a really an interesting, more interesting edge on it, if that makes sense. There's potential here for these characters to appear in other shows that they have planned. Shows like Secret Invasion or Armor Wars were kind of like teased, I think, here. But like WandaVision, which I loved, WandaVision also felt like it had a kind of clunky wrap up. And once again, both of these productions were somewhat impacted by COVID. So I think I'm ready to say that right now, Marvel TV, Disney Plus Marvel TV has a bit of a finale problem. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I will be curious to see if they fix that going forward. So,
well, because they don't do finales, you know, ultimately.
Right. It's ongoing. You
know? Yeah.
The Marvel story goes ever on. Yeah.
And I also think that Falcon and the Winter Soldier really tested the limits of Marvel's sort of political savvy and kind of interest, you know, sort of capacity for introspection, because they really tried to walk up to something very serious and relevant. I mean, it's been relevant, you know, since for 400 years, but like it felt and it was like it was done well enough in certain moments, but then ultimately the machine took back over and it kind of made everything feel flimsy in retrospect. And I just wonder if maybe there is some sort of grim or, I don't know, defeatist lesson there where it's like, maybe the things should be a little more allegorical if you're going to handle them in the end as clumsily as this episode did. I don't know.
Yeah. I'll wrap up this section with you, Richard, by saying, even though it had nothing, it felt like it sort of had very little to do with the episode itself. I did enjoy like the party scene montage at the end. Like, I like seeing these characters happy. So I like seeing Bucky sort of like on the way to healing and in a yeah. family environment. Like, that's a lovely thing to see. I was disappointed that we got a short shrift on his sort of big confession to his friend that we met in episode one. That felt like it could have been a really big moment, and then it was just a really quick moment, you know? Yeah. But
and also they needed to, yeah. I think, better illustrate what that meant for the old man, you know, because mm-hmm. otherwise it was like, well, are you just trying to make yourself feel better? Or what right. comfort is this guy going to take in your story about how you killed his son? Right. And then they kind of just like didn't deal with that.
Yeah. So, but we will see, like, you know, also, I don't know what to say. I wanted more. I'm excited for Loki, which is the next Marvel show, because, I don't know. That looks like it has maybe by being less. No, I don't know what to say. I might cut this out.
You're,
okay.
you're still flustered by the white after Labor Day thing. You're just like, you just can't comprehend how that's going to work.
Yeah. We'll see. Maybe Sam will take the rest of the year off. Anyway, Richard, thank you so much for going on this journey with me. I know that we will be talking again very soon about Mare of Easttown, but if folks want to find you in the meantime, where can they find you?
Covering the Oscars on VF.com, probably tweeting about the Oscars. That's all I'm thinking about for the next 2 days. As, by the way, I recover from my second dose of the vaccine.
Yay!
Everyone go do that if you can. Please. I want to leave my house.
Get your super soldier serum shot. All right. So thank you. Thank you to Richard. And we will go now to Anthony's interview with Carl Lumley.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
All right, for this portion of the podcast, we have a very special guest with us. I would like to introduce Carl Lumley. He is a veteran stage and film and television actor. You've seen him in Doctor Sleep, in Alias, in many other things. He is wonderful as Isaiah Bradley in The Falcon and the Winter Soldier. Carl, thanks for joining us on the Still Watching podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We've been discussing your character endlessly ever since you made your first appearance on the show. He is such an intriguing man. he's got obviously a powerful backstory. I wondered if you could begin by just walking us through the process you went through with Marvel in the discussions about him and what they, how they described Isaiah Bradley to you in your initial conversations.
He was described as something that had been hidden away, that was part of a program, and that in the series of comic books where he was first introduced, they basically ran through a scenario of a group of individuals who had also been experimented on with the super serum, and he was in that group, the survivor.
Did the real history of the Tuskegee men who were part of the experiments that the American military conducted, did that come up at all in the conversation?
My understanding is it's predicated on it. It's the reason, or at least the vehicle they chose to use in telling the story of a man like Isaiah Bradley, a black man who is a patriot and believes deeply in this country, despite the what would feel like a contradiction in terms of the way he and other black people are treated. However, I think that's very true to form. Those people who wanted to fight the most very often were people who had been denied the most and who thus believed the most in freedom and in the ideals of the country, and were willing to go to battle to help the country adhere to those ideals or meet those ideals in the areas where it hadn't. So, he felt familiar to me. He felt familiar to me through the history of the country. There have been various individuals who would otherwise have disappeared, but someone found out and felt that his story was due some attention.
Mm-hmm. You're no stranger to comic book characters. You've played Martian Manhunter, you voiced him in animation, and been part of the DC universe for a while, and now you've joined the Marvel universe, crossed over to the rivals for a while and played Isaiah Bradley.
Yeah, I'm pretty ignorant about the war of the comic world, despite the fact that I've done so much of it. It's all the same thing to me. It's just, I guess, another form of literature. Mm-hmm. And I think of it as literature because there are many, 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 many people who, for whom that was the way into reading. There are lots of immigrants who learned a lot about English by reading cartoons. Yeah. And then the stories that are told, I think, are not unlike fairy tales or other mythologies where they're based in human behavior and human foibles, and they get an opportunity to discuss things which otherwise might not come up in quote-unquote polite conversation.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to ask you, is what you thought the utility of comic book storytelling and on screen and in the pages might be in terms of addressing real-world issues. It kind of helps us put a little bit of abstraction on the reality and yet see the reality. It almost gives us a little bit of distance, right, to examine it.
It's what probably the best of society can hope for when it works. I had the idea that there are individuals who have gifts who are willing to apply them, and in almost a sacrificial or heroic way, mm-hmm. Are more concerned with what's happening in society than they are with themselves. I mean, they take terrible falls and, they fly around and they hit walls and they explode into bits, and the more super heroic of them, they get ripped up a little bit, and the ones who are less superheroic have to mend. It's just like, yeah, it feels like it's just like living. It's but it's prettier.
What were your some? You mentioned like the initial approach from Marvel, but did you have any deeper conversations with Malcolm Spellman about the story he was trying to tell and what he was trying to convey?
Only through the text, never in person. But I just felt like the text that I saw, what had been written for Isaiah, spoke volumes. And then with the research that I was able to do and the research that I've done my entire life, mm-hmm. I felt I had certain understandings. I had a father who reminded me in many ways of Isaiah, you know, a man who was, in my view, not well treated by the Republic, mm-hmm. and who in his case, just chose to be the best person he could and put those ideals into his children and help us all to succeed in a way that he could not, that he and my mom were not able to.
Do you think that's something that's generational as well, is that older people who lived through those harsh times, you know, at a certain point, just surviving is a noble fight, is a part of their stand that they make? And do you feel like the baton passes from generation to generation, that the push for change becomes more pronounced, maybe a little bit bold?
The idea of being an older survivor, I think, does not necessarily mean that you haven't had survival in mind for a very, very long time. I'll just say for myself, I think, and for a lot of, I remember being maybe 10 or 11 years old and being shown Emmett Till's, the newspaper with Emmett Till. Yeah. And, you know, I don't remember being able to make sense of it. It just seemed that the entire thing couldn't be what it was. But I do know that I, from that moment, and probably to this day, have had some trepidation about being in the South. And I've been in the South quite a bit. So I guess what I'm saying is these pieces of information, these notions of menace or ill will, they can be fed in, and people deal with them and don't even know necessarily that they're dealing with them. They just become a part of the way you move in life, a part of the awareness you have.
Can you talk to me about working with Elijah Richardson and the relationship between Isaiah and Eli, his grandson? I know it doesn't get a lot of screen time. We don't see too much of them and the lives that they lead together. But what's your feeling about what that relationship is and what he hopes for his grandson and what his grandson sees in him or knows about him?
They have one another. I am not sure mm-hmm. who else they have, but they have one another. And so there's the connection of generation and the idea of, yes, definitely passing on what you can to try and help equip a young individual moving through in a world that you no longer really understand. So I think the point that you make about being older is a good one in terms of the world continues to move and change, and progress continues to be made, at least in this country. I feel very good about saying that today. And progress is possible. So people who have experienced a rough history and get set in their mind the way things work, it's up to the next generation when they are told by that generation, it's impossible, you cannot do it, it will never happen, it's up to the younger generation to say, well, it may be impossible to you, but if it were possible, I wonder how I might do it.
Do you think that same sentiment exists between Isaiah and Anthony Mackie's character, Sam Wilson, the Falcon? You know, he wants to use the shield and make a difference, and yet Isaiah tells him no self-respecting black man would carry that shield.
For me, and in my understanding of Isaiah, Isaiah's talking to himself. It's almost like a self-deprecation. Isaiah wanted to represent his country at the highest level he could. And that super soldier program was like any elite program. You, had to be qualified in any number of ways, but B, most importantly, you had to be motivated. So I think ambition was always a part of what Isaiah was doing. And I think, you know, game recognized game. You know, he looks at the Falcon and he sees both the potential and the realization of excellence, which anybody who has a standard can appreciate. And he also sees the possibility for all of the disappointment that can come if you reach too far and fall short. Mm-hmm. But as he was at that age, there's no way anyone can tell you that. You would listen to.
What do you think makes a good Captain America? We've seen in the show the version that doesn't work with Wyatt Russell's character and the cruelty he exhibits and the arrogance he displays. But what do you personally think are the qualities that make, made Steve Rogers a good Captain America or in general would make a good Captain America? We don't know yet whether that will be the Falcon picking up the shield or someone else, perhaps.
Captain America should want to recruit the skills and the aspirations and the dreams of Americans across the board, that his judgments about the way he goes about doing what he does should involve compassion as well as, what the word be, efficiency in dealing with things that should not be, that he can take stands that he feels strongly about, that perhaps not everyone might agree with, but he's inside and living in his truth and wants that for everyone else. I think also being a listener. Mm. I think the Captain America needs to be a listener, of course, just to assess whatever he is being told and make decisions, but even more than that, to allow people to have a say.
You mentioned earlier the research you did for this part, and I believe you said at one point, you know, research you've been doing your whole life. And I wondered, were there you've addressed some of them here already, but were there any other specific things from your own personal experience that you wanted to layer into the character? You were born in Minnesota, right? And your parents were also immigrants, if I'm not mistaken, from Jamaica. Is that
correct? That's correct.
So you got the experience of being growing up as a black man in America, but also the son of immigrants in America. And I wondered how that may have fed into your performance as Isaiah.
James Baldwin said, if you can face it, you can bear it. If you can bear it, you can change it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, that's what I see a lot of in Isaiah. So you ask the question, is he resting? I think in the way you might rest after you run a marathon, it might be a good long rest.
Yes. You know, the Falcon and the Winter Soldier deals so forthrightly with, race in America, what it means to be black in America. And it has a lot of heavy ideas on its mind, and I know this story was devised a long time back and it contains certain, unfortunately, time less elements about its story, but the fact that it's airing to the public during the trial of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd, and the finale comes the week of Chauvin's conviction on those three counts. It's hitting at a time where the conversation couldn't be more profound. And I wondered if you had any thoughts about the way it tackles those subjects and the times we're in which those thoughts and ideas that are within the show are being heard by a very wide audience.
I'm surprised, actually, because, you know, the reality is I only saw the portions that I saw. I didn't know what the entire thing would be like. So I was so pleased and surprised by what this is. And because I'm not a comic aficionado, I know very little. So it just strikes me as quite beautiful. The relationship they have, the possibility for the relationships that people will have with one another, the idea that there are a lot of people who have superpowers like will, intention, and belief, and no wings or metal arms. Mm-hmm. And they all have a place in the battle for freedom and justice. Mm-hmm. Cool stuff. Yeah.
Well, as we wrap things up, can I just ask you how you're doing, how you're feeling as somebody who I know you worked in Minneapolis for the Associated Press when you were early in your career as a journalist. Did you grow up in Minneapolis?
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of joy. And it's, in some ways, it might seem strange because when one looked at what one had as evidence, it's hard to imagine that there could have been another verdict, yet we know there not only could have been, but there have been other verdicts where things have been quite evident to us as viewers, but for one reason or another, justice was not done. So I would say there are all sorts of reasons that I have not been wildly enthusiastic about Minneapolis through my life. Winter, a part of that. But on this particular day, and I must say on yesterday, and actually since the 25th of May last year, I'm aware of that I've been away from Minneapolis. I had been away for quite a while, and it had changed tremendously when I went back. And I would also say I had all sorts of friends and acquaintances in Minnesota. There were some very good white people, some very, very good black people, some excellent Native American people, Asian people, a mix of people. But the problem was always placed on the people of color. It was up to us that, you know, our strides were applauded, but they were our strides. And, you know, we were running in a separate event. I think I'm proud of Minneapolis today because I think a lot of people are running in the same event and helping one another along. And I think that I don't know that I've felt a sense of community as much in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, as I have at a distance sometime in this past year.
That's beautifully said. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us. And
absolutely.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
All right, Anthony Bresnikan.
Joanna Robinson.
First of all, that was we just listened to your interview with Carl Lindley. It's fantastic. You did me a solid. You stepped in this week. I had some stuff going on this week. Mm-hmm. You picked up that interview for me and did a crackerjack job. And Carl was so great to listen to. I guess I just wanted to start by asking you, like, were there any moments in the interview that stood out to you that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, you know, I've admired him as an actor for a long time, and I can tell he's somebody who puts a lot of thought into his role. Mm-hmm. And Isaiah Bradley's it's not the lead of the show by any means, but I think he carries so much of it because the show is about history, and Isaiah's he's not just a man who lived through that history, but he's a man who is that history, is part of that history, and made that history. And I thought that I keep wanting to call him Isaiah because I'm so his voice now is in my head as that character. But Carl, he's an actor who has lived through some things. As he said, he's not just a black man who's lived his whole life in the United States, but he was a journalist. Before he became an actor, he's the son of immigrants. Mm-hmm. So he has the American experience, and this is a show that's about that. And I think he brought all of that to the performance. And I really, I always feel a great privilege when somebody just trusts you to share those things. So I hope people enjoyed listening to it. I certainly did.
Yeah, I loved how very honest a lot of his answers were. The Carl Lumley, the Isaiah Bradley of it all really did work for me in this finale. It's one of the few things that I just really felt sold on all the way through. Mm. And I honestly think that comes down to performance more than anything else. I just think he was really emotionally accessible in a way that made his and he illuminated some of this in his conversation with you when he says, you know, these things about like no self-respecting black man should carry that shield, that he's talking about himself more than anything else, which I thought was sort of revelatory. And it helped me understand his reaction to seeing Sam in this episode, if that makes sense. And I got emotional seeing, you know, him on display in the Smithsonian.
I thought that worked really well.
Yeah.
You know, there's a one word on this in this episode that I think is extremely significant, and I'd love to hear Malcolm Spellman talk about the use of it. And that's the word matters.
Mm.
You know, Black Lives Matter. That's something that's on our minds a lot now, and I think most decent people can agree upon that and support that. But there's a line where John Walker says to Morgenthau says that she's sorry she killed, or that Lamar died, that they're not trying to kill people who don't matter, which I thought was a very cruel thing to say. Like that's a bad way to end your I'm sorry, you know. I thought Wyatt Russell gave a good performance of, you're saying his life didn't matter. Well, Lamar was a black man, but would you say he's also he's a black life, but is that also a blue life? You know, there's the phrase blue lives matter as well, which is extremely controversial and sometimes thrown out as a way of diffusing or distracting. But that just the use of the word matters, I thought was very loaded. What did you say?
So interesting. I hadn't flagged that. I think that's really interesting. I do think, you know, we haven't heard my conversation with Wyatt Russell yet, but he talks about his character, John Walker, as and Captain America, even when he was Steve Rogers, as like the ultimate cop. that like he is the world's cop. You know what I mean? And so like, which is okay. It's so Yikes. Interesting. No, it's so not necessarily in a positive way. Cause he's talking about like, he was talking about in the context of the transgression that John Walker did in episode four. Mm-hmm. Right. And transgression's a really gentle way to put it. And I just think it's so fascinating that if he thinks of John Walker as a cop that way, I just find this quick and easy redemption for John Walker in this episode so strange.
It bothered me so much. The nod that Sam gives him sort of at the end. I'm glad they didn't like, you know, lock arms or, you know, like high five it or something. But the nod itself, I'm like, I don't feel like John Walker deserves it. To me, he's more of a villain in this series than Morgenthau was. But
I think that's not where they want to land with him. You know what I mean? I think him trying on that suit and becoming U.S. agent, like I know that Julie Louis-Dreyfus showed up and as the Contessa, and we were like, oh, is she nefarious? Is she up to no good? But it seems like maybe not. That maybe she's, you know, working for the government. Yes, is inclined to maybe play faster and looser with the rules than other people, but that ultimately, like, John Walker feels like he's a hero and he gets to be a hero again. Now, maybe he's going to be wrong about that, but, like,
I think he thinks he's a hero just for picking up the mail. Like, that guy.
I know, exactly. But it's just, like, it's baffling to me because I really do feel like the show, and I talked to Wired about this, you know, and he was like, he thinks, Or I will say this, what they were aiming for was for the audience to see John's point of view in the end. I didn't get there. I have some empathy for him, for his loss and stuff like that. But like, I don't see him having done the work other than like throwing down that crappy shield and deciding to save people. That one act is, for me, not him doing the work to really engage with what he did, you know?
I think they successfully blurred the line a little bit, but the line to me was still pretty clear. And I think that's good. You don't want him to be wholly evil. Like, I think that's one of the strengths of Marvel villains, is that they don't go to, total, what's the mustache twirling villain, you know, like
I don't think they were even trying.
They don't go like, full Snidely Whiplash, you know, but I like that they complicated it a little bit. That's why I like that matters line. I think that's because I think about that and it's I have to chew it over. Like, I'm not really sure what it means that he says that. And what does Lamar's life mean? And why was she so callous about it? I thought it was a good addition to the script in that way. And I don't think that Contessa is good. I mean, I love her conversations with herself. Like, that's how I would have done it if I had, but of course I didn't. Or did I? Oh, but I didn't. You know, like, sure, her little back and forths there are great. And I think she just had a bunch of prisoners executed is what she's alluding to. So I think she's pretty much on the dark side, but she is, she does delight in the malevolence a bit. Don't you think?
I'm unsure because,
Well, she doesn't think she's a bad guy.
Here's the deal. Like, I don't think I guess I'll say this. I don't know that we're getting Thunderbolts now or that this is a Thunderbolts team now. I think it's something else. And I think it's tied to some of the future shows. I mean, this is a great place to do some forward looking speculation. Mm-hmm. And it ties into some. I've been thinking about, I told you this before we started recording, but I've been thinking about Richard and I were talking about Marvel having a finale problem. And Richard said something about like, that's because they don't end things, right? They just go on. And with WandaVision, I tended to be kind of soft on the WandaVision finale because I'm like, well, I'm not thinking about it as a finale. I'm thinking about it as a pivot point towards Doctor Strange and Captain Marvel 2 and stuff like that. And so maybe my mistake in assessing this episode is thinking of it as a finale, because Marvel doesn't really do finales. And I should think of it as a pivot towards Secret Invasion or Armor Wars. They're like upcoming shows. And the Skrulls question is a really good one for us to consider in this. Skrulls, I don't know why you would be listening to the advanced placement section of this podcast if you don't know this already, but Skrulls are these shape-shifting aliens who, we got to know in Captain Marvel and Spider-Man Far From Home. Ben Mendelsohn is the most famous actor who's played a Skrull. And it's a shape-shifting alien. The big twist of Captain Marvel, right, is that the Skrulls are benevolent, because in comic book lore, famously, the Secret Invasion plotline, the Skrulls are a malevolent force that have invaded Earth and have been here for a while. And people who you thought were your friends or your pals or your leaders are actually Skrulls in disguise. We saw a bit of this with Ben Mendelsohn in Captain Marvel, right, where he is posing as the head of not S.H.I.E.L.D. at that point. Or maybe S.H.I.E.L.D. Anyway, Skrulls mm-hmm. are coming or already here. And the Contessa saying thing, like, things are about to get weird, made me think that, like, one of two things. Either she's a Skrull herself, possibly, or she is building a team of superpowered people who are willing to work outside the lines in order to combat the Skrulls. Because Samuel Jackson's character, Nick Fury, is fairly Skrull sympathetic. And if she's very anti-alien, maybe she needs her own team of people to combat them.
I feel like we are building toward Thunderbolts.
Okay.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but I do think that this would be, and whether Thunderbolt Ross, the character played by William Hurt in the movies, is a part of that or not, I think it's sort of, that maybe depends on whether the actor wants to return, but I think it has to do with creating a team that's willing to do the things that people like him want. I think his problem with the superheroes is, yes, they save the day sometimes, but they weren't really under our control. Thunderbolts would be like, okay, the Sokovia Accords essentially failed because we have, enhanced beings kind of doing their thing and not really mm-hmm. following those strictures. Well, what if we get some who are on board with that? Let's just put together a team that believes in the Sokovia Accords, at least in theory, and they will do what we ask them to do. And the Contessa thing, like, let's say she is representing the interests of, say, the United States. I'm not really sure who she stands for at this point. But I think when she says what we need is a U.S. agent, now that's a name drop of the nom de guerre that John Walker uses in the comics. Mm-hmm. But also it reminded me of kind of our interventionist practices. And, we've done some things, many things as a country that are not cool. Think about like the way we destabilized Chile and bolstered the Pinochet regime. That's fascism. And we've done that in lots of countries. And I think, what does an agent do? Represents your interests, right? Like, we didn't really care what happened to those other countries as long as it was in our interest. And I think that's what the Thunderbolts would stand for, is people who do what this maybe government or quasi-government deep state, to use a phrase, wants them to do. So I think that maybe that's what she's kind of doing. But when she reminded me of like these sort of CIA figures of the past and maybe the present, who feel like, well, we know best. We'll cause a discord in your country if it benefits us and maybe lowers the price of a gallon of gas.
I hope you're right that they're headed towards the Thunderbolts, because I felt like they were trying to code John Walker as heroic at the end here. Like, he's celebrating his wife. He's like, I'm back, I'm back, I'm back. I get to be a hero. And I hope you're right that he's being sort of recruited into something a little darker or something like that. I just felt like the show wanted us to be like, oh, he's figured it out. Good for him. And maybe I'm wrong, but I hope I'm wrong.
It was a little too far in that direction for me, for sure.
Yeah.
But I felt like if I'm being charitable to the writers, that maybe what they were saying is, we are kind of in this together, whether we like it or not, with some of the people who believe more extreme things.
And that is something that Wyatt Russell said. So maybe you're right in that assessment, where he's like, he's the guy who, like, you're going to need to call him, and you're not always going to agree with what he's going to do, but you're going to need him. You know what I mean?
Is he the Joe Manchin of the Marvel Universe? Oh, no.
All right. So I want to talk about Skrulls and another character, because our producer, Dave, put this idea in my head and I've been thinking about it. I feel very frustrated with the Sharon Carter thing.
Yeah.
But Dave was like, but what if she's a Skrull? And then I was like, okay, maybe if she's a Skrull infiltrating the government as Agent Carter, I would not be as upset.
She had that funny little disguise skin. I don't know what you
call
mission, it. Like,
it's a Mission Impossible mask.
Yeah, but it's like, it's not like a rubber, you know, in Mission Impossible, no. They always have that moment where, like, the eyes come loose and then you see them peel off the big rubber face. But like this, like, it was just, it's almost like a wet Kleenex you put over your face and you just, like, peel it off like a cobweb.
Yeah.
It was a pretty cool little thing, but can you imagine being a Skrull and being like, oh, I gotta wear this, like, face altering, like, sheen.
A face on my face.
I can already change into whatever. So I don't know. Maybe that would be.
Maybe. I'm just trying to make it make sense to me, because, like, this heel turn for Sharon Carter, I can understand someone being left out in the cold and feeling that way. I already ranted about this to Richard, but, like, I cannot align. I was waiting for a double twist, mostly because I cannot reconcile Steve Rogers not checking in on Sharon Carter before he goes. Can't make that work for me. So,
I mean, in a way, he kind of abandoned her after Civil War, right? She helped him and Sam get their gear back and get away. And then they got pardons and she got left behind. Like, you know,
well, that's the narrative, but I just don't think that that's what he would have done. He goes on the run with Natasha, but I feel like he would have tried to connect with her, Sharon, in that time when he's on the run.
I mean, maybe he didn't. Remember what I said in a previous episode about going back to thousands of years? One of the problems is you have soldiers who fight for you, and if you don't take care of them at the end, they become a problem for you later, you know?
Right, but that's like the U.S. government not taking care of its veterans. And if we're talking about Steve Rogers, like, if you're going to Steve Rogers, like, that's – and I'm happy to accept that Steve Rogers isn't perfect. That's fine if we want to have that conversation. But we're not really having that conversation. We're just sort of yada, yada, yada-ing over it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I feel a little salty about it.
But there was that word again, agent, when he says, welcome back, Agent Carter.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, that again, there's a name drop for you. That's a familiar term. It immediately conjures up everything we know and love about Peggy.
Mm-hmm.
But, maybe an agent is, in this show, is now becoming a dirty word that you're not necessarily standing for what you believe, but representing the interests of others. I don't know, but I agree. When she was getting her pardon, I turned to my wife and I was like, wait, isn't she like the bad guy? Like, are people not aware that she's the power broker? And they're not, right?
Well, I'll pat us on the back for this. It's a theory I picked up from a Redditor, so I'll pat them on the back at the same time. But, like, that was exactly the theory that I had last week, was that Sharon Carter was going to show up, pretend to be helpful.
Yeah.
Which she
did.
Call it. I mean, that Redditor called it, but I latched on to that because it felt satisfying, except for this, like, Steve element. You know what I mean? So anyway. The agent, U.S. agent and Agent Carter. It's true. Two agents.
Were you satisfied with the scene at the end with Isaiah Bradley in the Smithsonian?
Yes. I got very emotional about that. Once again, I just think that has a lot to do with Carl Lumley and his performance, which is just so iconic to me. So yeah,
he validated that speech in a lot of ways for me. That the great, well, maybe I don't know how you feel about the speech that Sam gave, but he gives that speech on TV that kind of puts it back on the real power brokers. You know, this leadership body that's trying to repatriate people, I liked that when Sam gives him this spiel there at the end, when, and I love how casually Carl, Isaiah lifts this tree that has a root system and a giant barrel, half a barrel. Like, he just kind of lifts it up like it's a potted plant and puts it on his porch. I love the casual use of his superpowers to do some heavy gardening. But like when he goes, you think he has, you know, struck at the heart of what Isaiah believes. And Isaiah goes, you know, I almost bought that for a minute. I think it's just that little bit of that cuts the treacle of it, that cuts the sentimentality and says, yeah, all that sounds good. We'll see. I love that little bit of cynicism that he injects. I thought that helped make the speech work. I almost bought that. And then, and then the bit at the Smithsonian, the reason it resonated for me again goes back to that word matters. And they don't say it in this scene. And it's not the same as Black Lives Matter, but it's a way of showing Isaiah, you don't have to come out and be out in the world. Like, you can maintain your cover and your protection for you and your grandson, but you mattered. The work you did, the life you lived mattered. And here is the proof. It is now in a museum. It matters a lot. And I think mattering is something that is meaningful. And it I think at least offers some sort of healing to Isaiah that, you know, that Bucky was trying to do with the people in his life that he was crossing off his list in Steve's book.
How did you feel about the Bucky resolution with his like friend from episode one?
I thought it was very interesting because I kept wondering, in some ways I feel the show chickened out in that moment, because my question is, okay, he has said this. What comes next? What does the old man say? And we don't really get that. Now, we also don't get Kumbaya, where, okay, you killed my son, but now you are my new son. Like, where they're back at the sushi bar, you know, knocking back sake and chatting with the barkeep. Like, I like that when he looks through the window, is there's that relationship. I got the sense that it was over, that the friendship he had with him was something he sacrificed so that he could give this man the truth that he said he craved. Now, did he want that truth for real? We don't really get the answer to that. I kind of wish we did. You know, and like, I think sometimes there's not in all cases, but maybe the hard truth is not really what we want. Maybe the healing is more important. Maybe moving on is a little bit more important. Maybe that friendship that Bucky gave him was better than being alone at the bar. You know, that's a question I have. Do you have those questions at all? But I like that it wasn't tidy, that it was sort of a fracturing of that relationship. But I'm not sure what the right thing was there.
Yeah, I think I just wanted to see more of that. More of that. You know what I mean? Like, this isn't a case where I'm mad that there was so much action in the finale versus, like, how I felt kind of about WandaVision. Because that's what this show has been, right? It's been like an action show. I just think, you know, given some of the things that Sebastian Stan has shown us that he can do, I think there was opportunity for him to have that here. It would have been nice, I guess.
Yeah.
That's all I'll say. Something, and let me just loop back one last thing about Sharon Carter, which is she was originally supposed to be in Infinity War. Like, they were supposed to, well, in one version of Infinity War, Marcus and McFeely, the writers of that film, were going to show Steve and Sharon, like, in an apartment, making a go of their relationship or something like that. So, like, there was initially this idea that, like, Cap doesn't just smooch someone in Civil War and then never check up on them again, right? It's a very uncap thing to do. And then they cut it just because there was like too much that they had to take care of, understandably so. There's a lot going on in Infinity War.
When he goes back in time to be with the aunt,
yeah,
that's kind of weird, right?
that's his niece. But like, I think they wanted to just really like lean. I mean, if you watch Endgame, they just lean on that Peggy Carter thing, that like foot on the gas from the beginning of Endgame to the end of like him thinking about her, him looking at her photo, et cetera, et cetera. And so, like, at that point, there's no room for Sharon. And so then they have to, then they're kind of trying to make that, like, no room for Sharon work thematically for Sharon. Like, how can we make that interesting for Sharon, that there was no room for her in these movies? Okay, she's left out. How does that feel as a character? Yeah. And I just don't, it involves me believing something of Steve that I can't believe of Steve. So I will never feel right about it, is how I feel.
I understand. Yeah. That's valid. Yeah. I get you.
Yeah.
It kind of treats her like she's a summer camp girlfriend for him, right? Like he's camping out in the 21st century and then he goes back home.
But I feel like even Steve Rogers would write a nice letter to his summer camp girlfriend to be this was magical, but now I have to go, or something like that. So I don't know.
Do you think she's pining for him? Like, do you
I think she's mad.
Like, feels ghosted? I think she feels ghosted in general by everybody.
Yeah, so. I think she's mad. Less, not even from a romantic point of view, just from a and you abandoned me point of view. So
yeah, I mean, there's like kind of no love, no time for love, Dr. Jones, and when you're superheroing, but like she, I think it's more. Yeah, we talk about the romantic side of it, but I think it's a much more about like the betrayal of just being. We were on a mission too. We were teammates.
Yeah.
You know,
like, imagine him doing that to Natasha. You can't imagine him doing that to her. He never would.
He kind of did it to Tony, didn't he?
Did he?
Yeah, that like was taking like, the side of Bucky over him and not telling him the truth about what happened. Like, you know, and remember that famous line where when he goes, you know, I'm sorry, Tony, he's my friend. And Tony says, so was I.
Yeah. All right. I'll start thinking about the flaws in Steve Rogers' eyes.
I can't believe I'm the prosecution for Steve Rogers in this conversation.
Well, I guess, I mean, this show is so much about Steve Rogers, even when it's not, right? Because it's just sort of like, how do we fill this vacuum? And what is the appropriate material to put in that vacuum now for the America we live in now? Because Steve is a representative of an America of a bygone era that never really was that America to begin with, but we liked to believe it was. And so who's a more realistic Captain America for us to have? I will tell you, and I said this to Richard, my favorite part of anything that Sam did in this episode was like the little confab he had with that woman in the helicopter to like get him to help rescue these people. That felt like a really Captain America thing to do. And Sam's empathy, his empathy for Carly, his empathy for a lot of people, his past as a counselor, all of that is a tremendously interesting thing to put into the Captain America role. Like Steve had it, you know, obliquely, but Sam has it just more directly. The empathy, eventual empathy for Bucky. It's an evolution of a character. And I just wish I had more space to see it executed better, I suppose. That's what I would say.
I understand. I agree.
Yeah. Anything else we really loved about this episode or want to talk about in terms of this episode?
I think we might have covered it.
All right. We're going to have one more wrap-up episode next week. Anthony and I will be back with some special guests next week. So I would really love to make that as much of a mailbag maybe as we can. So if you vehemently disagree with us, if you loved this, if we feel like we missed something in this finale, you can email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. You'll hear from us and some other folks next week. And for now, let's go to my conversation with U.S. agent himself, Wyatt Russell. I would love to go back to the beginning. You've told the story, I'm sure, ad nauseum about how Marvel first came to you. And I know that they did not come to you telling you that it was for this show and for this character, but they came to you with like a character description that interested you. And I'm just curious if you can recall sort of what it was about that character, like how did they describe the arc of this character in a way that hooked you?
Well, the way it happened was they called and said, we'd like you to read for, you know, this Marvel show. And, they didn't tell me anything about the character other than that, like, he's complex, you know? And so I was like, okay. what else? So they kind of, there was nothing other than this like kind of dummy sides that they give people to read. They're not actually sides in the show. They're just like,
right.
They come up with like, they're tonally what they're looking for. And, so, you know, I went in and did it. I had no idea what I was doing other than just, you know, hopefully interpreting the sides the way they want. I honestly had no idea. It was like, okay, I'll do it. And then they're never going to call me back and move on with my life. And then they said, yeah, we really liked it. And we'd like you to be the guy. And I kind of was like, great. Like what, you know, what guy? I have no idea what I'm doing. And then they brought me into the office and unveiled the character, and they kind of showed me a picture of Captain America and a rendering of it, and I was like, oh, you know, like, I kind of confused, like, do they want me to play Captain America? I was like, yeah, because that wasn't sort of what I was looking at or thinking about doing, or thinking was a good idea for me to do. I don't even know. It was like kind of like, oh boy. And then I didn't know if that was the right choice for that. And then they kind of explained to me, oh no, he has this sort of, he's a different guy. He's coming in, he's a replacement. He's got, you know, all these issues that he's bringing along with them. And I thought, oh, when they started talking about his complexities or his issues, problematic behavior, was when I thought, okay, yeah, there's an interesting take. I think I can come up with an interesting take on it so that I have an idea of what I'm doing and not like kind of blowing in the wind, which is what I was afraid of, not knowing what to do in like a big machine. Then I was able to grab onto something that I thought, okay, you know, if they believe in me, and what I want to do is what they want to do, then it's a good match. And it was,
you know, I've obviously you're a great performer, because this character, John Walker, is so different from anything I've ever seen you play before. And you know, from what I've seen of you, the other, more laid back, kinder characters are closer to your own personality. And I'm curious, how do you interpret it when Marvel comes to you and says, like, we think you're the guy for this part, which is so separate from what we've seen from you before, you know?
I think we live in a time now, unfortunately, where people don't want to disseminate between different roles actors take on. They just want to kind of see them as brands. It's easier to digest. It's easier for people to digest people that way. And it's also easier for companies to sell actors that way, when you become less dimensional in certain respects. So I've always tried to not be that, just because it's not what interests me about doing, about acting, or being in film or making movies or doing anything in it. So I was really excited that when they, when what I was doing performing wise matched up with what they were, you know, imagining. Also, it took time, right? Like, it takes time to figure it out even while we're shooting. And they were open to me trying a lot of different things so that we could all together find a tone that would strike, strike the right chord. So I felt that was a vote of confidence in my ability to bring something, I guess, unique to that suit, instead of, you know, the same old, whatever somebody would have wanted to expect, which I know people, you know, they wouldn't have wanted the same thing anyway. I mean, that's the antithetical to why I make the show. So I was really excited about, you know, they're taking what they see as my ability to play someone that's different. And, you know, it's a vote of confidence, right? So
how you talk about sort of, you know, continuing to try to find the character as you're shooting the show. So how did your understanding of the character, did it change, or did you have any major breakthroughs, as you were working, on shooting on location?
Kari and Zoe were the real point people on set for, you know, going forward with questions or directionally where we were going to take a scene, you know, how that was going to be, the Malcolm's writing was going to be interpreted. So what was great about my work with them was that they were such wonderful collaborators in that they let me do the total wide range, the total spectrum. Like I did scenes that were totally humorous because I thought it was funny, you know, just because I thought it was funny. I think that's what you have to have to create interesting stuff, is the freedom to just go, I just want to try it just because I want to try it for no other reason. I don't know why. You know, there's nothing else in, there's no other reason that I think it's funny or I think it's sad or I think it's, you know, whatever. And they let me do all that stuff and directed me that way. So Carl would be like, okay, do it this version. And now do the one where you find the humor, and then do the one where, you know, you find the tragedy in this situation. You know, there'd be like many different versions of the same thing, so that when they build the film, the show, that they have the ability to cut together what they believed was tonally the right performance, because that's what you're doing, right? I'm not making
right
the edit. So I'm trying to give them, you know, I have to have trust in the people I'm working with, so that when I do give them a wide range, they don't fuck me and create a character that's totally not in line with what we had talked about. So I trusted them in that process, and from everyone's reaction to the show, I it's like, you know, I inherently trusted them for a reason, and I'm glad it paid off.
You talk about, like, you know, not wanting to have fear around this performance, but is it ever scary to depict someone who sort of finds themselves on the wrong side of their own morals? Like, John Walker goes to an extreme that is not just beyond what we would expect, but I think beyond what, I don't know, the John Walker who's in that locker room at the beginning of the season would expect from himself.
Yeah, I think that the way you play characters, no matter what the character is, you know, you can play the craziest character in the world, like the Joker, for instance. You know, Heath Ledger and the Joker is like always the example everyone uses because it was so good, but he plays the character real. It's not, he's not twirling your there's no mustache twirling, which is totally fun in some stuff.
Right,
mustache
right.
twirling is totally great in some respect, but for this character, it was the reality of him was what made it interesting. And so whenever you do that, you know, for him, when you sit back and don't just take that kind of person at face value, which is what most people are doing when they see him, right? They take, and what we do a lot of today. We see lots and lots and lots of media. The only way to really digest that media is to take things at face value. We have to. Otherwise, you couldn't digest the amount of information that's given to us every day. It would be impossible if you actually deep dove on every single person that you were interested in. So what was interesting right. about him is that when you just sit back and think about a guy who's gone to war, he's seen... Medals of Honor are usually things that we as civilians look at and say, oh, he's a great Marine or he's a great soldier. He did great things. He's awarded this Medal of Honor. Well, what that means to you is not equivalent to what it means to him, because that day for him was the worst day of his life or her life, and he will never get it back. It's so many friends had to die. So many people had to die. So many horrible things had to happen for that medal to be awarded, that it represents failure in John's life. And that's sort of what we took it to mean. And so that is what's driving him to do what he's done. And so not taking into account that he was thrust into this role fresh off of being in Iraq and Afghanistan and seeing some probably pretty awful, horrible things, you now put him in a scenario yeah. where you're like, oh, but okay, now you're a cop. And, you know, go do what you do. And so it's like, okay. And when that guy's a bad guy. And then Nico's bad. He plays on the wrong team. And he killed my partner. What would he do in Iraq or Afghanistan? He would go chase anybody down that looked like he was in the same uniform, and that dude would be dead. And so to him, yeah. he's looking around going, you know, knows that now this is publicized in a different way that it hadn't been in his life before, and feels wronged when it's taken away from him for literally, in his mind, just doing his job. But he's unaware of all of these other aspects that Captain America needs to be in this situation, and feels his back has been their people's back has been turned to him. And that's why I think for him, he's an interesting character, because in that courtroom scene, like, he doesn't apologize for what he did. He just tells the government, I did my job, and now you're taking this away from me. So you trained me to do it. You trained me to be here. I'm the one you wanted. And now you're telling me that it wasn't what you wanted, because you're just reacting to outside pressure. And he's not used to that pressure. And so you're seeing him fall apart at the seams, because he's never had to look at himself that way. And so that's what's interesting, is you're finding a person on the precipice of having to look at themselves for the first time through a very different lens. And that's what I thought was inevitably, you know, ultimately interesting about his arc.
Given that the medal represents failure for the character, how do you interpret the shield building scene at the end of episode 5?
That is just him going further down the rabbit hole of, I'm going to fix this my way. And he only knows how to do things really honestly in this, as we've seen in this series, trying to be somebody that he's not. He's trying the entire time to be this version of Captain America that he's seen as Steve Rogers, who's like upheld all of these ideals, and he's an idealistic figure. And now when that idealism has been cracked and taken away from him, instead of folding, John's not the one, he's not going to fold and go away. He's going to double down, and now he's going to do it his way. And that shield is, when he's, you know, it's obviously not made of Wakandan steel. It's just, right, it's a shittily welded together shield that just operates in a very, crude level. And that's how John operates best. It doesn't mean that he's going to be the best guy, or that you're going to want him at a dinner party, or that you're going to want him being Captain America. You're going to want him to be doing a lot of things, but it does mean that when you call that guy to action, you call them because you have to have him, because he's going to get the job done no matter what it takes. And that's a dangerous guy, because you don't, like, he's going to do some good things, and it's going to be very difficult to separate someone who you need for the help. You need to do the work, and only it can be done the way he kind of does it. But you also don't want that guy to stick around too long, because he's dangerous. So I think that shield just, you know, it represents the sort of his the crude nature that he's going to exude moving forward.
And how do you feel about where John Walker lands overall in the series?
How do I feel about where he lands? I think it's interesting. I think that, hopefully that the arc was taken from someone who you really are set up to not like. You're set up to despise him. You're set up to really, you know, just in every way, shape, and form, not like him. And hopefully just be taken down the journey of understanding where he came from, whether or not you like it, agree with it, don't agree with it, see it as something that's necessary, see it as something that's unnecessary. You're going to understand why he's doing it. And so I think that was achieved in a certain respect, and, you know, is a nice promise for someone who is very dangerous and very comfortable is doubly dangerous. And so I think that he's much more comfortable with who he is, at the end of the series, because he's grown into himself in a very dangerous way.
Can I ask you about that uniform reveal?
The reveal is funny, because I don't know if they kept it in, but I think they did. When I went to see the costume, I thought, you know, like, there'd be, you know, they got a lot to deal with. But when I went to see the costume, I thought, oh, they're gonna, like, it's gonna be different. And it's really the same exact costume, but it's just like, it's just black and red. Like, it's just black. So it's the same exact suit, but it's just black. So I came out and said, you know, it's the same suit, but it's black. Like, it's like a kid on Christmas who like opens up a present and you're like, it's cool, but it's like, I thought it'd be like different. And it's like, so I don't know where they're going with it, but I thought it was kind of funny that it was, you know, it's cool. It really was cool that it's a different color, but it's like the same suit. So I didn't know how to react to it to be like, yeah, cool. Because I felt like if I reacted like, yeah, awesome, then some people would be like, cool, but it's like the same suit. And so we'll see, you know, what for this show, it's kind of funny. He comes out and he says, you know, it's the same suit, but it's black. You know, another little, you know, it also provided a fun thing for me and Julia to just like, you know, have a connection beyond what was on the page in that scene.
Obviously, we don't know exactly where things are going to go for John, but what's your sense of where things are going to go for John?
I don't know, to be honest. I really don't have any idea. Part of what the way I approached Marvel was like, it's all, you know, it's all your last time you're going to do it. You know, it's like, but I think I approach everything that way in life, where it's the last time you're ever going to do it. So, you know, do it that way and then see what happens afterwards. I think Marvel operates that way in a really cool way where, you know, they don't make decisions before they see what works. Mm-hmm. I don't think, you know, I'm not part of any of this decision making, obviously. But they do a really awesome job of living in the moment in their own universe, which keeps them current, also keeps them interesting, I think. And for me, I live that in my life. So I did this show going, okay, like, you know, I don't know. I have no idea what happens afterwards. I'm not thinking about it. I could care less. I'm just doing what I'm doing right now. And the more you can do right now, the more it ends up usually being interesting for whatever reason. I don't even know why. Not necessarily, like, I don't think I can articulate why, but staying present is like, you know, very buzzword. Everyone's like, you just gotta stay present. You gotta stay present. Like, present is everything. But it is. And so that's why, you know, that's where I'm at now with it, is like, I guess they'll let me know.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't know.
You called John Walker in this Captain America role a cop. And obviously, like, there's a lot going on in our current conversation that makes this show feel even more urgent maybe than it did when you guys were filming it initially. And I'm just wondering how many conversations you had, you know, with Zoe, with Kari, with whomever, about, you know, the reality of policing in America and how John Walker relates to that.
It's innately built into the character. It's innately built into Captain America. It's just that you view it differently now because of what's gone on and what we've mm-hmm. seen. So innately, Captain America is in the Marvel world, the number one law enforcement mm-hmm. person in the world. That's what his job is. And, so what, in terms of conversations we had about it, I don't like having conversations about what's going on in the world and how it applies to what I'm doing now, because it doesn't necessarily translate to the piece of footage that you're doing. I only care about in terms of when I'm working. I only focus on, I should say, not care about. I care about everything, but I only focus on what I'm doing as it pertains to how it is in the story. And if the story reflects that, which, you know, I'm not the writer, mm-hmm. right? I'm not the people doing it. If the story reflects that, then that's the way to go with it. If the story doesn't reflect that, but I feel the need, because of some point of view that I have in life, to implement that into my character, it doesn't necessarily mean that's the best version for that point of view. And if you put that point of view in the wrong place, to me, it can
negatively impact that my own point of view. Mm-hmm. So the only way that I ever do anything in movies that pertain to what's going on socially is if it's built in. And in this, it was innately part of it. It was built in before it, before we started shooting. So all of those things that came up, which was interesting, you could say tail wagging the dog or not, were things that you have Malcolm Spellman, Anthony Mackie, they are Black men in America. That's their point of view, right? That comes from a deeper place. And that point of view is applied to this show because they're writing it.
If you want, you know, if people see you in this and they're interested in your performance and maybe they haven't checked out some of your other work, I have my favorites of what you've done, but I'm curious, you know, like what you would want someone to watch next to maybe get the best sense of the range of what you can do.
Lodge 49.
Yeah, that's great. I'm a big fan of Everybody Wants Some. I think you're great in that movie. So.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, Everybody Wants Some was like the most fun experience of all time.
All right. Well, Anthony, we are almost at the end of all this.
Almost.
We'll see you back next week. In the meantime, where can folks find you?
Oh, they can find me over at vanityfair.com, writing away. And yeah, that's about it.
All right, we will be covering the Oscars this weekend, so stay tuned for that. And as I said, Anthony and I will be back next week with one last Falcon Winter Soldier chat, and we will see you then.
See you then. Bye.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ Audio Network like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.